Welcome to the May 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape. The Freeman on Tape is the audio cassette edition of The Freeman, published by the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533. Side 1 of The Freeman on Tape, May 1990 edition, contains excerpts from Private Property Rights, an Endangered Species, by Paul D. Kaminar. Fee Interview, Juan Runam. The Real Case Against Taxes, by James L. Payne. Eastern Europe, The Economic Stakes Are High, by Gary V. Small. Roger and Me and Free Enterprise, by James L. Doty. Plus, Perspectives. And on side two, a fee classic, Where There Was a Will, by Jess Raley, and Building a Barn, by Hannah Lapp. Private Property Rights, an Endangered Species, by Paul D. Kaminar. Mr. Kaminar is Executive Legal Director of the Washington Legal Foundation. Last July, John Posguy, a 58-year-old self-employed truck mechanic, was sentenced to 3 years in jail by a federal judge and fined $202,000 for violating the Clean Water Act. This is the longest prison sentence ever meted out in the United States for an environmental crime. No, Mr. Posguy wasn't the captain of the Exxon Valdez that ran aground in Alaska, spilling millions of gallons of oil, nor did he dump toxic or hazardous wastes into any river or stream. His crime? Posguy was sentenced for placing topsoil and clean fill on his own property without permission of the federal authorities from the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Sparing no expense to nab this criminal, the EPA even staked out the property with secret surveillance cameras and took several aerial photographs to capture the crime on film. John Posguy, who immigrated from Hungary in 1956, works 7 days a week out of a small garage behind his house, fixing trucks to support himself, his ailing wife, and his two daughters. His home is located across the street from a 14-acre dump site in an industrial area of Morrisville, Pennsylvania, near Trenton, New Jersey. Having saved enough money for a down payment, he bought the property in June 1987, and mortgaged his small wood frame house to finance the purchase. He then began the Herculean task of cleaning up the property by removing over 7,000 used tires that had been dumped there over the years, along with other accumulated junk such as rusted auto parts, before placing clean fill and topsoil on 5 acres of the site. Meanwhile, the Environmental Protection Agency and Corps of Engineers paid several visits to Mr. Posguy, claiming that the dump site contained some wetlands and therefore required a permit from the federal government before fill could be placed on the land. The site, however, isn't listed on the Department of Interior's National Wetland Inventory map. In addition, Posguy claims that local officials who coordinate the permit program with the Corps of Engineers indicated that no permit was needed if clean fill, earth, sand, dirt, was placed on the property. The EPA had enough of Posguy placing topsoil on his own land, so they set up secret surveillance video cameras to record some of the filling activity. Armed with this evidence and aerial photographs, the EPA had Posguy arrested and indicted in September 1988. For discharging pollutants into waters of the United States. Keep in mind that the pollutants consisted of earth, topsoil, sand, and clean fill. Paskai's arrest and indictment were trumpeted in a press release issued by the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, who now heads the criminal division of the Justice Department. The government was going to spare no expense in criminally prosecuting Mr. Paskai, although there are ample administrative and civil remedies available to the EPA to handle such regulatory matters. Violent criminals would have to wait the prosecutor's attention. The trial took place during the Christmas holidays, December 26th through 30th, 1988. The lead prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Seth Weber, was so confused by the Clean Water Act's requirements himself that he mistakenly thought that Mr. Paskai needed a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit from the EPA, which is required for factories discharging wastes into water, rather than a simple fill permit from the Corps of Engineers. If an educated prosecutor doesn't know which permit Paskai is required to have, certainly Paskai, a Hungarian immigrant with little schooling, could be forgiven if he found the morass of regulations a little confusing. Nevertheless, the jury, obviously impressed with the videotapes and the government's expert witnesses, found Paskai guilty. John Paskai was sentenced on July 13, 1989. At the urging of the prosecutor, U.S. District Court Judge Marvin Katz sentenced Paskai, who has no criminal history, to 3 years in jail, the maximum sentence under the Clean Water Act, fined him $202,000, ordered him to be placed on probation for 5 years after he serves his three-year prison term, and to restore the property not to what it was, but to a pristine wetland, according to plans by the Corps of Engineers. Paskai then asked the Washington Legal Foundation, a pro-free enterprise public interest law and policy center, to represent him before the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Incredibly, the court upheld his conviction on January 12, 1990, without holding oral arguments and without stating any reasons for its decision. If the Supreme Court doesn't reverse the case, the sentence imposed on Paskai would be the longest prison term ever served for violating the Clean Water Act, or, for that matter, any other U.S. environmental law. Why was Paskai targeted for the most serious penalty the law has to offer for simply putting clean fill on his own property? To quote the prosecutor, "A message must be sent to all landowners, the corporations, the developers of this country, that fines, probation, and short prison terms are a thing of the past for environmental offenses, especially those involving wetlands, because of President Bush's no net loss of wetlands policy. The government means business, at least when it comes to prosecuting the little guy." For at the same time federal prosecutors were going after John Paskai, they were prosecuting another water polluter in Florida, O.C. Mills, a 58-year-old retiree, and his son, were convicted and sentenced to 2 years in jail for placing 19 loads of sand on his property without a permit, even though Florida officials told him that none was required. Mills, who defended himself, proved no match to the three federal prosecutors assigned to the case. Unlike Mr. Paskai, who was luckily placed on bail pending appeal, Mr. Mills was ordered incarcerated while his appeal works its way through the courts. Mills already has served a year of his sentence in a federal penitentiary. In short, the government intends to use the Paskai case as a precedent to start imprisoning corporate officers and other businessmen for environmental offenses, even though heretofore wetland cases have been prosecuted only in civil proceedings. To most Americans, scarce prosecutorial resources would be better spent fighting major polluters and violent criminals than imprisoning citizens whose only crime was to place clean fill on their own property. Bremen Interview. Juan Runan. On June 4, 1989, Chinese troops stormed Tiananmen Square in Beijing and massacred hundreds of students and citizens, thus bringing to an end the peaceful protests which threatened to topple communist rule. What many do not know is that private entrepreneurs worked side by side with the student protesters in advancing the cause of liberty. Among them was China's best-known businessman, Juan Runan. Born October 29, 1946, Juan Runan was in college studying engineering when he had his first taste of repression. With the fanaticism of the Cultural Revolution sweeping the country, Mr. Juan was forced to interrupt his studies by the authorities and sent without reason to labor as a railway worker in the countryside. He eventually graduated and went on to a position with the National Academy of Natural Sciences. Mr. Juan grew increasingly frustrated with the communist system and began to look for ways to promote a free market in China. In 1984, he started Stone Corporation, which produces computer software and English-Chinese word processors. Starting with a loan of 20,000 yuan, Stone Corporation grew rapidly and reached sales of 8 million yuan in 1989. The company presently employs 2,000 workers and has branches in Hong Kong, Australia, France, and California's Silicon Valley. When the pro-democracy protests began in the spring of 1989, Mr. Juan provided material support for the demonstrators in Tiananmen Square and helped organize negotiations between the students and government. He became convinced that the government would crack down if the square wasn't evacuated, but his warnings to the students went unheeded, and the massacre soon followed. Mr. Juan decided to flee after the June 4th crackdown and is now wanted by the Chinese authorities. On January 17th, 1990, having just returned from a six-week trip abroad, Juan Runan spoke with journalists Daniel Prouzen in Paris. Asked what inspired him to start up Stone Corporation, he replied that the main reason for starting up Stone Corporation was not to make money, but to explore the ways and means of reforming China through free market means. The main problems that needed reforming, according to Juan, had to do with ownership. In China, the means of production are mostly state-owned. For example, in the countryside, you have something called self-contract responsibility system, in which land is owned by the state, but individual farmers are responsible for how the land is used. They fill state quotas, but the farmers can choose what to grow and can keep what profits are made from the surplus. The problem, though, is that the land is still state-owned. As long as private ownership is not established in China, says Juan, it will be very hard to stimulate the economy and expand upon this initial development. The Real Case Against Taxes by James L. Payne. James L. Payne is a research fellow at the Independent Institute in San Francisco. He is writing a book on the overhead cost of taxation, hosting the federal banquet. If we hate taxes so much, why do we keep on approving them? The answer is that the opposition of most Americans to taxes is shallow. The argument that most people use against taxes is self-interest. Taxes cost us money. But the real case against taxes doesn't rest on self-interest. It rests on altruism, on a concern for the health and prosperity of the community. For in the long run, most taxing and spending programs turn out to be harmful in three important ways. First, because tax monies flow in automatically, government agencies face no day-to-day discipline of the market. The result is a consistent pattern of inefficiency. Tax and spend programs are a way of destroying wealth, a way of impoverishing the community. The scandals, corruption, and waste we read about in our daily newspapers are the fruit of this system that separates donors from their donations. A tax system destroys wealth in a second way, in the collection process. In this highly legalistic day and age, tax systems involve forms and instructions, regulations and reporting requirements, enforcement systems, penalty procedures, appeals, and litigation. In addition, tax collection systems impose losses by discouraging work, savings, and investment, and by channeling effort into tax avoidance and evasion activities. My study of the federal tax system shows that the overhead costs of operating this system amount to between 60 and 70 cents additional burden for each tax dollar collected. This monetary figure does not count emotional and moral costs, which include abuses of power by the bureaucracy, the frustration of dealing with red tape, and the fear of doing something wrong and being treated like a criminal. Finally, perhaps the most important objection to a tax and spend program is that it undermines the spirit of helpfulness and community pride. To its promoters, a tax seems attractive because it guarantees automatic funding for a well-intended project. They don't have to go around urging people to be public-spirited, appealing to their generosity. The problem is turned over to government officials, who presumably fix it, and the rest of us can go back to our personal pursuits. If you want to live in a caring, helpful society, you have to teach that caring, helpful people are needed to solve its problems. And that means turning away from government and its coercion-based tax system as the problem solver. Eastern Europe. The Economic Stakes Are High, by Gary V. Small. Mr. Small is a computer engineer in Manchester, New Hampshire. After 45 years of Cold War, and with the apparent blessings of the Kremlin, several major Eastern European countries appear to be racing each other to embrace the benefits of democracy and capitalism. Unshackled from socialism, Eastern Europe could become a major consumer and producer of manufactured goods on the world market. Opening up Eastern Europe to free enterprise will bring in much-needed capital from foreign investors, provide lessons in business and technology to the local workforce, and create opportunities for local startup companies that will be needed to support the factories built by foreign investors. Foreign involvement is needed for several reasons. First, foreign investors have the capitalist know-how to set up productive businesses. They have access to and detailed knowledge of Western markets. And perhaps most important, they have access to the hard currency and financial resources of the West. Once production and exports are increased, Eastern European countries will start to earn hard currency that can be reinvested in local businesses so as to bolster the country's ability to produce for its own needs. Or the money can be used to buy consumer goods, raw materials, and capital goods from abroad. On the opposite end of this spectrum of possibilities is the vision of an Eastern Europe reduced to a charity case, and dependent upon handouts from the industrialized nations, much like many third world nations that overdosed on socialist policies. The people of Eastern Europe have lived under a Big Brother socialist system for a long time, and may not be willing to give up the security blanket of a welfare state for a competitive system in which they sink or swim on their own merits. The laziness that is bred and nourished by government guarantees of job security, minimum wages, subsidized housing, and other such benefits is a powerful counter to the sow what you reap philosophy of capitalism. The most likely scenario for Eastern Europe is a mixed economy, retaining socialist qualities while adopting some capitalist attributes. The government control inherent in the socialist philosophy is something that appeals to politicians and bureaucrats of every persuasion. If, however, capitalism is adopted with the fervor of a religious conversion, the industrialized world and newly developed nations could see both profits and competition from Eastern Europe in the not-so-distant future. Capitalism adopted as a reluctant admission of the failure of communism, however, will result in a relatively stagnant Eastern Europe with the same problems that plague many other nations with controlled economies. Roger and Me and Free Enterprise by James L. Doty. Dr. Doty is a professor of economics at Chapman College, Orange, California. Filmmaker Michael Moore's very funny satire, Roger and Me, has opened to almost universal critical praise and audience approval. Unfortunately, the fact that audiences across the country are largely accepting Michael Moore's message, hook, line, and sinker, is sobering, especially when one considers the distorted view of free enterprise depicted in this cleverly constructed documentary. Roger and Me documents the impact of General Motors' decision to relocate automobile production facilities from Flint, Michigan, to lower-cost operations in Mexico. The film's message is that relocating assembly plants outside the United States had a devastating socio-economic impact on the people of Flint. The film's villain is the free market system that allows GM's supposedly callous CEO, Roger Smith, to undertake reprehensible acts while holding himself and his company above accepted norms of decent behavior. It should not be surprising that Michael Moore takes a good deal of artistic license in documenting the facts. It isn't mentioned, for example, that while some jobs were lost in Flint, the majority of workers living there are still GM employees. Nor does Moore document the fact that GM has poured billions of dollars into building new and modernizing existing U.S. assembly plants. A more serious problem that calls into question Moore's ethical standards and reliability as a journalist is his scrambling the sequence of events depicted in the film to support a point of view rather than a sense of reality. For the sake of argument, let us overlook these problems and accept for the moment Moore's cinematic view, that the unbridled use of free market capitalism led to the demise of a once healthy and vibrant local economy. When such a view is taken, the logical follow-up question is what sort of policy Moore would propose as an alternative. I suppose most morally conscious people would advocate the passage of laws that prevent GM or any other domestic automobile manufacturer from closing U.S. assembly plants. The implicit assumption here is that laws can be enacted to prevent the cruelties documented in Roger and Me. Many public crusaders undoubtedly believe that jobs as well as cities can be protected by legislation designed to serve national interests. Before accepting this assumption, let's consider the cost of such well-intentioned public policy. First of all, the compassionate feelings of Michael Moore and other public crusaders evidently extends only to U.S. workers. The fact that GM created jobs for Mexican workers and improved their earnings potential is considered only in a negative light. GM's recent decision to build an assembly plant in Hungary would probably also be attacked by these same humanitarians. it is ironic that compassion is often constrained by nationalistic fervor, while the forces of free markets work against such discrimination. But even if justice and morality extend only to the U.S. border, keeping Flint, Michigan alive and well by means of laws and regulations will also work against our fellow citizens. Consider, for example, the higher prices that consumers will have to pay for automobiles as a result of steeper tariffs and quotas that are now necessary to keep domestic automakers in business. The higher prices represent a subsidy on the part of consumers to maintain inefficient production facilities. While the jobs saved in Flint might bear witness to what a benevolent government can do, the true costs are spread thinly among many and are difficult to observe. In the aggregate, the costs are significant, but at an individual level, the marginally higher price a person pays for automobiles is not the stuff upon which entertaining documentaries are born. The visible impact of free market forces might not always be kind and gentle. In serving the needs and desires of consumers, the invisible hand of free enterprise forces producers to respond. When they do, they profit. When they don't, they fail. The process isn't necessarily pretty, but it works amazingly well as long as governments don't get in the way. Perspective: The Banking Crisis by Hans F. Senholz. The Savings and Loan Bailout, Valiant Rescue, or Hysterical Reaction. Published by Libertarian Press, Spring Mills, Pennsylvania. The American financial system was fashioned by legislators and is regulated by regulators who together created a cartel that is crumbling under the weight of its own contradictions. The system rests on government force rather than voluntary cooperation. Enmeshed in countless laws and regulations, it was unable to cope with the rampant inflation of the 1970s and the globalization of capital markets during the 1980s. Most policymakers are resisting the only rational conclusion that can be drawn. The time has come to dismantle the financial cartel, of which the S&Ls are an integral part. It is an aberration and abomination. If a cartel structure, which restricts competition and divides the market, does not function satisfactorily and inflicts painful losses on the underwriter, it is reasonable and just that it should be abolished. When all expedients of the cartel system have failed, we may try freedom. American Science by Bruce N. Ames, Chairman, Department of Biochemistry, University of California at Berkeley. I have seen science in operation in many countries. One strength of American science is the high level of independence given to young people who have the freedom to join the system, cooperate, and compete with their fellow scientists and be judged by their peers. On the other hand, in societies that have strong central planning of science, the positions of power are fewer and more important, and the incentives to act politically to advance one's career are very strong. As a consequence, people are corrupted by politicking and distracted from producing good science. Another enormous advantage in Western science, particularly in comparison to the socialist countries, is the flourishing of small companies that can rapidly provide the chemicals and the tools that are needed for the constantly changing interests of scientists. End of Side 1, The Freeman on Tape, May 1990 edition. Please turn the cassette over. Side 2, The Freeman on Tape, May 1990 edition. A Fee Classic, Where There Was a Will, by Jess Raley. Mr. Raley, a freelance author, speaker, philosopher from Gadsden, Alabama, remembers how it was in Appalachia in the early 1930s, when government support payments were initiated. He also recalls what he designates as the commodity programs of food handouts to the poor, and how the recipients of such largesse began to lose their independence and respect. This article is from The Freeman of December 1979. In America today, there seems to be near universal awakening to the fact that something is wrong. Individuals in vast numbers are no longer inspired to excel in their respective fields of endeavor. Business leaders fault labor, government, imports, and employee apathy. Labor blames business, government, and the low wages paid in exporting countries. Rank-and-file citizens generally believe government, labor, and business to be the primary culprits. Government suspects business, foreign ingenuity, lack of respect for the dollar abroad, and malingering personnel on production lines. Every cognizant individual, old enough to remember when the zest for life was of necessity honed to a fine edge, is fully aware that the intangible known as the American will has, in fact, diminished perceptibly. Only thing I can't understand about the case of diminishing will, and it really bugs me, is so many people asking why. One of the few things I know for an absolute certainty is why the American will is less vivacious, aggressive, and steadfast than it once was. Why so many individuals feel little, if any, responsibility for themselves, their job, family, and government. I know why, because I was there when it happened, saw the seeds of irresponsibility planted, and observed the first bitter fruits of that harvest. In January 1933, I found it necessary to drop out of school. Dad was having a difficult time just feeding the family, so I decided to move to my granddad's farm in Appalachia, where I could hopefully earn my own living. Being in my middle teens at the time, I even expected to save enough money to return to school. The old farm was in a steep, narrow valley, and except for a few small level plots, the productive soil had washed away many years before. This was not particularly important to me, since I didn't have the means to cultivate the land anyway. But I did find innumerable ways to make a living. I learned to hunt and trap animals for their fur, dig medicinal roots, especially ginseng, and where to sell them, find and rob wild bees, pick and market wild berries, and numerous other ways to earn money. As a matter of fact, I had a ball in Appalachia, lived well after the first few weeks, and actually accumulated enough in the process to return to school. I was therefore really just a transient who learned from the local residents what I needed to know to attain my appointed goal, and then I moved on. Everyone in the area must have been well below poverty level, if there was a poverty level in those days. But the people who lived in the larger valleys and owned more level land seemed to be doing fairly well. It was the real poor folk, however, who lived in the ridges and small eroded valleys where I was, and were almost as poor, that I came to know and admire. These were the hustlers who parlayed their meager crops with what they could earn from other sources to sustain their families. In my opinion, man, living in an organized society, has never been more free and independent than those people were. They accepted full responsibility for themselves and their families. No one expected anything from a source other than their own efforts. Sometime that summer, the government program started. An agent came through, offering to pay farmers from $11 to $21 an acre, depending on how good he judged their cotton to be, to plow up all or any part of it. Most farmers plowed up some part of their crop. With cotton selling for about 5 cents a pound and the area's history of low productivity, it was the practical thing to do. The difference in payment caused considerable resentment among neighbors, however, since in midsummer most farmers think their crop is as good as the best and better than the rest. I had put in a small crop that year, after all, by plowing for an elderly gentleman in exchange for the use of his mule and plow, a day for a day. Since I had only 3 acres of cotton, I didn't destroy any of it. I did get a preview, however, of how government programs would be administered, when the agent paid his cousin top money for 7 acres of very poor cotton, while offering or paying at or near the bottom level to most everyone else. Next came the commodity program designed by the philanthropists in Washington to feed the poor better than they could feed themselves, while reducing the mountains of surplus commodities. The program seemed to work well in that it achieved these goals. No doubt its sponsors were quite pleased with themselves. But I still hurt when I remember what it did to most of the people who participated. In retrospect, these first ripples of government intervention were very small indeed in relation to the tidal waves that have followed. However, they were that first step of a long journey, a foot in the door that had heretofore been strictly private, the first pitch of a whole new ballgame. At first, only a few of the more indolent signed up to receive commodities. Then, as others saw their neighbors eating better without effort than they could eat by scratching as hard as they could, more and more people capitulated. It was like watching trees in a virgin forest fall and knowing they would never grow quite so tall again. Envy and resentment played a major role, along with nagging spouses. But for whatever reason, when individuals signed up for commodities, they seemed to become different people, lose the essence of their zest for life. Everyone in the area must have been eligible to receive commodities. At first, only a few signed up, so the people who had accepted the job of distributing them were forced to get out and beat the bushes in an effort to find people who would take the mounting piles of food off their hands. I happened to be at a friend's house one day. We had cut a bee tree and were dividing the honey, when a commodity agent came by looking for prospects. He explained that the food was piling up and that he had to move it to hold his job. When we declined his offer, the agent asked my friend point blank why we refused. And I doubt to this day that a better answer could have been given. "I don't do nigh as good a job supporting my family as I would like to do," he said. "But I well know whose job it is." That, I believe, is a classic example of the will once so prevalent that built America. The will so many people are hoping their fellow citizens can recapture in this age. By the time I left Appalachia, it was easy to detect participants in the commodity program just by talking with them. People who had been eager to help cut a bee tree, dig a load of rhododendron and ferns to sell, or any of the numerous projects that offered some small remuneration, were no longer interested after being on commodities for a while. More than this, their thinking changed perceptibly. Americans, since the Revolution, had felt responsible not to government, but for government, in the same sense that they felt responsible for themselves and their family. As individuals accepted or were forced to participate in various programs, they changed positions in their own mind, placing government in the parent role of primary authority and responsibility. In less than 2 years, fully one-third of the people in the area were accepting government handouts in lieu of individual will. The things I saw happen in that remote region were, of course, being acted out in every nook and corner of these United States. As the years passed, more and more people became addicted to an ever-increasing number of government programs. Industrial workers, protected by powerful unions with unrealistic contracts, obtained in many cases with the aid of government pressure, often do no more than dabble at their work. Extra effort and ingenuity are not necessary to hold a job. As a matter of fact, motivation is often frowned on by fellow workers, where just drifting with the flow has become the norm. After all, if the company goes broke, the employees can always draw their pennies. Since the stone of necessity no longer keeps a cutting edge honed on individual will, the American economy has been forced to draw more and more on that reserve we hillbillies are wont to call gut fat. Capital, labor, technology, and motivation invested before the American will was inhibited by government handouts and restrictions. In those days, a man was responsible without recourse for his own house. He could invest his means in a business venture, knowing that as the owner, he could hire acceptable personnel, direct operations, enjoy the fruits of success, or suffer loss if the venture was a failure. The people employed by such a man knew they could do their job well and stay on the payroll, possibly moving to a better position if the business prospered, or they could fail to show incentive and find themselves terminated. A longtime friend of mine has been associated with railroads all his working life. He and I were discussing this gut-fat proposition recently, and he ventured the guess that if a railroad were built from scratch today, rights of way included, the builder having to contend with all the regulations and restrictions prevalent at this time, it would cost at least $100 to ship a peck of wheat bran on said railroad from St. Louis to Chicago. No doubt my friend exaggerated somewhat, but I would be unwilling to promote such a project hoping to prove him wrong. With American productivity deteriorating progressively, rank-and-file citizens, as well as leadership in government and business, are voicing grave concern about the erosion of this element known as the American will. Even coming late in the game as it has, when our place in the sun is much less secure than it once was, this near-universal awakening should be good for the country. I must admit, however, that I would be a great deal more elated if cognizant adults would quit playing like they don't know what's causing the trouble. This breed has been known to pour water on a drowned man in a sincere effort to revive him.
Building a Barn by Hannah Lapp. Hannah Lapp is a dairy farmer and writer in Casadega, New York. One day early in 1974, Dad said, "Let's build a new barn and milk 80 cows." And not one of us offered to knock down the suggestion. It was just as though we were all waiting for him to say it, so we could add to it our own hidden aspirations. Everyone from Dad, who worked nights at a canning factory, down to the littlest child, Nathan, who felt sure he needed more to do, was itching to embark on a project big enough to accommodate more of our energy. Milking 20 cows didn't come close to employing all of us at our home in Casadega in western New York. My sisters Rebecca and Drusilla still worked night shifts at the ice cream factory and kept wishing they could get away from it. Dad was an AI, artificial insemination technician for American Breeder Service, besides holding his factory job. The older girls still worked for produce farmers in the lake area off and on during most months of the year. What we really wanted was work at home, and it had been only Dad's reluctance to operate on borrowed money that held us back this long. If we were going to invest in a large barn and silo and buy the cows and equipment to go with it, we were going to do some thorough planning first. Our labor resources were not questioned, for there wasn't one of us in our family of 13 who wasn't anxiously waiting to fill his role in making the operation run. It couldn't have mattered less to us that Dad said there would be no wages paid. We took for granted that we would share jointly in the rewards of an enterprise jointly run. Money was a more complex matter. We had never done something like borrow $20,000 for a barn, $10,000 for a silo, and another $20,000 for machinery and good cows. Why not just 50 cows, suggested the more skeptical family members. But the voices of those who were determined to quit their off-farm jobs and work at home were louder. We debated and calculated hard and long. Finally, a compromise was reached that set the herd size at 60 cows and silo at 70 feet high by 20 feet wide. The total investment would be $50,000. The design for the barn was developed step by step through studying the barns of other farmers and listening to their comments. Although Dad wasn't an experienced architect, we determined to take advantage of our own family labor by building the whole thing ourselves. My brother Chris had a good head for calculations. We girls, down to the littlest ones, believed ourselves capable of becoming construction workers, and Dad expressed no reservations in the matter. Above the southern rim of our valley stretches a 200-acre forest with dozens of different kinds of trees, some of which could be used for lumber. The previous owner of our place had taken out all the marketable timber, but had left the hemlocks. Dad took to the woods with chainsaw, tractor, logging chains, and tape measure to cut the lumber trees we needed for our building project. Logging began that summer. Often Dad had only one of us younger children as an assistant. At nearly 9 years old, I thought myself just the right size to take this position, and somehow, perhaps because I was not yet bound to many farm duties, I got what I wanted. I followed Dad to the woods day after day, a serious, dedicated helper on the one hand, and on the other hand, an altogether frivolous youngster carried away by the charms of the deep forest. I carried tools, and even the chainsaw for him, and every time a tree was felled, I held the end of a rule in place as he marked out 20-foot lengths on its trunk. Dad stripped the logs of all branches, hooked them to heavy chains, and dragged them out with the tractor. I followed the path of the logs until we reached the wood's edge, then stopped in the shade to rest while Dad dragged them on down over the fields and hills for home. He usually returned after about 15 minutes, leaving me just enough time to do a little exploring or carve letters into a tree trunk. The silo men, as we children called the 5-man construction crew that erected our silo, came in late July. The excavating had been done for the barn, but the silo was the first to rise from the ground and let the world know that cows would live there. The silo men raised their scaffold ever higher, and the soft concrete mix now had to be hoisted far up the silo wall before being dumped into forms to constitute more wall. We children observed their work day by day and wondered how they could tolerate the height as they pushed toward the top of the silo 70 feet. Metal steps were one by one concreted into the silo wall, creating a ladder from bottom to top of the structure. One of the silo men used to shock us with his stunt of rapidly descending the silo with only his hands catching the ladder rungs while his feet slid down alongside. By mid-August, the 70 feet of silo were up, and the figures of the men as they worked on top looked dwarfed and distant. Atop the rim of the silo, they erected a 10-foot dome roof in bold green and white stripes. The silo now waited to be fed with 550 tons of corn silage. Since chopping that much corn by hand wasn't feasible, we bought a mechanical chopper to do the job and a brand new 70-horsepower tractor to pull it. The blueprint for our barn was shaped over many hours of time, hours spent by Dad, Chris, and my sister Lydia, crouched over big sheets of paper spread out on the living room floor. Dad may have been the head planner, but Lydia, who was a teacher, had to help with complicated figures, and 15-year-old Chris's natural ability with mathematics was invaluable. It was Chris who, under the occasional supervision of a contractor, laid most of the thousands of concrete blocks comprising our barn walls 140 foot length and 40 foot width. The older sisters picked tomatoes that fall, so Barbara, then 13, also learned the masonry trade. She and Rachel made the mortar by mixing sand and water with cement powder. They tried hard to get the mortar's consistency just right with the proper amounts of each ingredient. Sometimes the mix turned out too hard, or so soft that the block layer rejected it. Sometimes they mixed too much at a time, forcing the crew to work overtime to use it up before it dried. When they succeeded in turning out a batch that pleased everyone, they called it a jolly mix. After the block wall was up, we were forced either to accustom ourselves to working at steadily increasing heights or be left out of the game. Since no able-bodied lap worker was going to accept being left out, we one by one timidly climbed up to try the 8-foot wall. "You'll learn," Dad assured us. "Here, hold this." He placed the end of a measuring tape into Nancy's hand as she hesitatingly tested her balance atop the wall. Dad strode off toward the far end of the barn, drawing out the length of the tape, and then he did not stop. "Follow me," he casually called over his shoulder as he went on, holding one end of the tape as Nancy held the other. Dad's pace seemed impossible to match, and Nancy at first tried to draw back, but pulling against him upset her balance so badly that she found it was best just to keep running after him, all the way to the end. After such an introduction, she had little trouble with working atop the barn wall. Two ceiling beams, consisting of 2x8s, nailed together 4 thick, were to be set up the length of the barn. Now, how will this be done was always the question when we came to each new task, especially such a job as raising 140-foot-long beams to ceiling height and supporting them with posts. As with every other step in the barn-building process, the workers gathered to hear ideas, exchanged, and together improvised a plan. First, board racks were put on the bed of our old pickup truck, and the box stacked full of hay bales that reached almost to the barn ceiling height. The truck was parked inside the barn walls, and the 2x8s, constituting the beam, were nailed together in their proper position atop the load of hay. As more length was added to the giant beam, the truck crept slowly forward, and temporary supports were placed under the finished portions. Several workers carefully lifted the weight of the beam's free end each time the truck moved forward. Permanent pillars were made for the beams using old 6-inch metal pipe, which we filled with cement. Each pipe was planted in a 5-gallon bucket full of concrete and then sunk into a hole in the ground before it took the weight of the beam. 15 of these pillars, under each of the 2 beams, were to suffice to hold up some 100 tons of hay, which we would someday store in the loft. Snow fell on October 2nd that year, giving us qualms about completing our construction project before winter closed in. The work was not in professional hands, and progressed, but little by little. One late October day, when the sun shone and work was frenzied, the noise of a honking horn grabbed our attention. It was Drusilla, Nancy, and Levina arriving home from work and announcing with a good deal of ballyhoo that the tomato picking season was over. After that, the barn took shape fast. Each rafter for the gambrel roof was nailed together atop the barn ceiling, then painstakingly balanced by a team of 7 workers as it was raised to its permanent upright position. The roof peak rose 20 feet from the ceiling or loft floor of the barn. The loft floor, as yet, was just a temporary network of boards strewn over the joists. The workers learned to move about with confidence over these boards. Actually, it was too easy for confidence to take the place of caution. Levina once landed a foot too close to the end of a loose board, and it tipped, reared up, and whacked her forehead with the other end. She slipped down between the floor joists, but caught herself at chest level and hauled herself back up so fast that only a good bruise on her ribs remained as evidence of her sudden descent. Each family member had to make his own sacrifices in the rush to close up our barn before winter settled in. Off-time was reduced, and even our usual Sunday and evening Bible study hours had to be compromised. At mealtime and breaks, there were just a few minutes to relax before someone would get up to sound the action slogan, "Barn ain't done yet," sending a fresh surge of motivation exploding through our veins. With one accord, the group would be dashing for the construction site, the girls' skirts flying, and the chorus of a half dozen hammers would sound again. Sometimes the workers were served their snack of hot chocolate and popcorn while perched atop some board 10 feet above ground level. Barn rafters were done in a week, and laths were nailed across them, introducing the workers to steadily greater heights. By the time they reached the peak of the barn, they could monkey up and down the laths with skill and confidence. Rachel, next oldest to me, was the youngest Lapp to brave the barn roof. When we started to nail on the tin, neighbor Howard Spindler and his son appeared unexpectedly to speed up the process. Although they were initially skeptical of the roof heights, their strength and carpentry abilities proved to be a boost that cut the roofing time in half. It was with great relief that we closed up the roof, for stormy weather was in the forecast. December came before the gutters were all dug and forms nailed in place for concreting the floor of our barn. Starting with the milk house floor, we began pouring concrete on December 3rd and took until January 1st to finish. No one took account of the wheelbarrows full of soft cement that were wheeled over plank tracks to be emptied into board forms. But the concreting days, known for their long hours of strenuous work, were counted one by one. The advance of truly cold weather was cause for alarm. Even with portable heaters running inside the barn, it was difficult some days to keep the cement mixture from freezing before it hardened. The feat of driving a wheelbarrow weighed down with 250 pounds of gently rolling cement mix while keeping it from tipping or sliding off the board track demanded such a level of combined strength and skill that at first some of the girls thought it impossible. To spill your load was just out of the question, but so was refusing to try. One by one, the girls conquered the challenge until they found their uncertainty replaced by sheer anticipation over the daily arrival of the Dunkirk ready-mix trucks. Since the truck driver charged for his waiting time, the cement forms had to be ready on schedule, as well as several wheelbarrows with their drivers. "If there's one downright ugly task," Dad says now and looking back, "it's getting concrete forms just right and on schedule for the cement truck. Boy, I remember how it was when they bulged, or shifted, too. How did we figure we could do it?" One of the ways we got it done was by working late into the night, lanterns overhead, lighting the work area, where Dad, Mom, Chris, and sometimes Drusilla, Nancy, and Levina bent over trowels, hammers, boards, and levels, smoothing concrete and making forms for more. 10 o'clock at night was a very poor time to run into problems with your work, too. Levina hated to hear Dad grumble, which he was apt to do at that hour, so she tried hard to keep things running right and not complain herself. If she did bother with talking about the length of her workday, one of her sisters would probably just quickly retort, "Barn ain't done yet!" Except for electrical and plumbing jobs, which required professional supervision, the barn building was completed January 1, 1975. That afternoon, a blizzard swept into Casadega, enveloping us in fresh levels of cold and snow. On January 9th, we led our milk cows one by one down the road from the old barn and began, before a crowd of spectators and with some appropriate fanfare, to milk cows in the new barn. Since our new bulk tank was not yet in operating condition, we had to lug all the milk back up to the old barn for a few days. We just couldn't wait longer to take our cows out of the crowded old quarters and see them in their new stalls. The last 6 months of labor had centered around getting them into a clean, spacious, and comfortable setting where they would kindly reward us with returns on our investment. Beyond the teenage enthusiasm, aspirations, and innocence involved in the development of our 60-cow dairy, and beyond the sentiments of a family longing to share together in an honorable enterprise, there loomed some cold, hard facts. Casserly Farms was now an $80,000 business whose success depended on more than just good intentions and hard, honest labor. Each family member over 18 now worked under a $10,000 debt. It is such figures as these, and much bigger ones, that rob the simplicity from farming. In handling large sums of money, we make ourselves more than just common laborers. We become investors and businessmen, and the farmers who fail to acknowledge this and neglect the discretion of an investor are among those who eventually go down the drain, hollering for society, the banks, and government to bail them out. The investment per worker in our case was lower than in most other dairy operations we know, because we continue to rely on hand labor, where most others used machines. But there also are farmers who have readily outdone us in keeping debt down. The frugal, debt-free, and therefore successful kind may be rare nowadays, but those that remain are farmer businessmen as dedicated, tenacious, and shrewd as ever there have been.
End of Building a Barn by Hannah Lapp. Hope you have enjoyed this May 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape. For information on subscribing to The Freeman on Tape, write to The Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533, or call area code 914-591-7230. Epilogue, The Census. The true test of civilization is not the census, nor the size of cities, nor the crops, no, but the kind of man the country produces. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Civilization.